Go up to Psalm 6. Psalm 6. And just taking the words of verse 3 as our theme. O Lord, how long? O Lord, how long? Despite the claims, promises, and efforts of the promoters of health, wealth, and happiness, Christians get sick, grow old, have strokes and heart attacks, become deaf and blind, contract Alzheimer's and dementia, suffer poverty and persecution, and face, like many others, the scourges of civil strifes and wars. As one writer puts it, we too live in a fallen world and cannot escape participation in its evil and suffering. If you doubt this, you are either, one, ignorant of what many Christians face daily, or second, not old enough yet, for certainly if you live long enough, you too will suffer, or thirdly, kidding yourself, or fourthly, a combination of all three. What the psalmist does in Psalm 6 is to teach us what life is really like. What it is like for Christians. You see, in this psalm and in the mind of the psalmist, there is a mixture of faith and fear. A faith that wrestles. It wrestles with life. It wrestles in anguish. And it wrestles over perplexing issues. A faith that speaks honestly, realistically, without making any false promises or any credulous claims. Indeed, if I were to put it this way, the greatest antidote to the false and spurious claims of those who promote what is commonly referred to as the gospel of health, wealth, and happiness, the greatest antidote to it is Samaritan. Just taking these psalms, reading them, and singing them, and grasping what they teach, because they will equip us to face the realities of life. And we wrestle many times over complex issues, perplexing issues. We struggle sometimes. Indeed, we struggle many times with the things that we have to face up to. So what do we have in this sixth psalm? First of all, we have the discipline of God, verses 1 to 4. David speaks of being rebuked and chastened. O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure. He speaks of being rebuked and chastened. He is enduring this. He is experiencing this. This is one of the peculiar things that God does to his people. It's a strange thing. It's a peculiar thing that God chastens and disciplines his people. If you do not belong to God, then you will not, sadly, know anything of this. Because we read in Hebrews 12, verse 6, for whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. He chastens and scourgeth with the rod and with the reproof. God disciplines his children. Contrary to health, wealth and happiness, God does scourge. God does discipline. God does rebuke. He reproves. And discipline includes the following: war, plague, illness, rebuke, bereavement, loss, opposition, and persecution. Those are some of the things that God uses to discipline his children. And furthermore, some of the instruments God uses are in and of themselves evil. That may seem a strange thing to say. I haven't time to dwell on it this evening, but it is a fact. Nonetheless, the question that arises is, what is David suffering? Calvin makes this comment. Some have restricted the chastening to bodily disease, but it is more likely to be metaphorical, because the same complaint is used in Psalm 116, where there is no mention of bodily disease. Well, that may be so. Commentators still discuss whether or not it is one or the other. But whether it is trouble of body or trouble of mind or both, sometimes we have trouble of body. There's disease and there's sickness and there's illness and there's pain. Trouble of mind, there is melancholy, there is confusion, there are doubts, there are fears. And sometimes we have both. Whatever it is he is suffering, he acknowledges he is being disciplined by God. And that is the crucial thing that he recognizes. And in that, he lays down for the rest of us, shall we say, a rule of thumb, a principle for us to view the issues of life as God disciplining his children. So when things happen, whatever comes to pass, whether it be good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant, let us view them as God disciplining. He is correcting, he is shaping, he is guiding. To reprove, rebuke, instruct, correct, chasten, scourge, exhort. And he's using all the issues of life, everything that happens, to discipline his children. So David is looking beyond the actual experience itself to the ultimate cause, the ultimate source of these things is God. So he gives us a principle: view everything as the means of being disciplined. But he adds a second thing. He looks up to God. God is the author of all of this. God is doing these things. It's what Job does. When you read the book of Job, those opening chapters, that's what he's doing. Though Satan is the actual instrument of all his troubles, he looks beyond the instrument to the ultimate source, an author who is God. No matter where our afflictions come from, let us who profess faith to lift our minds always above, let us lift our minds to the God of heaven and say, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. To begin on our thinking with the supremacy of God over us, the lordship of God over us, that God is governing and directing, controlling, but he's disciplining us. And David, He yields to God's right to chasten, to rebuke him. He doesn't argue. He doesn't say, well, God, you shouldn't rebuke me. You shouldn't chasten me. He yields immediately to God's right to do so. He knows he needs it. And here we see something of the faith of David. But there is also fear. He pleads for leniency. Rebuke me, yes, but not in thine anger. Chasten me, yes, you have the right to do so. I need it, but not in thy hot displeasure. He doesn't plead, don't give me any of these things. Do not deal thus with me at all, but rather do not deal with me in terms of strict justice. Otherwise I shall be cast into perdition and eternal ruin. In Jeremiah 10, you have this spelled out for us. Jeremiah 10, verse 24, O Lord, correct me, but with judgment, not in thine anger, lest thou bring me to nothing. It's the same point. Correct me, yes, I need it. I need to be corrected and judged and tried, but not in thine anger. If you judge me, if you correct me in anger, you will bring me to nothing. So David is saying, yes, rebuke me, chasten me, but all with mercy. Do not treat me as you would treat the reprobate. They will perish. I deserve to perish, but oh, show mercy. Have mercy upon me, O Lord. He pleads the mercies of God. He pleads indeed the effect of God's present discipline, the effect it already has upon them. He says, I am weak. My bones are vexed. In verse 3, my soul is sore vexed. He says, see already the impact your discipline has upon me. I am a wreck, he says. I am weak and weary. And see how he also struggles with it all. He says in verse 3, but thou, O Lord, how long? How long, O Lord? Do we not also have that same cry? Yes, there is the faith. God is doing it. And we submit entirely to the rod and do reproof. But as it goes on and on, we start to fear. We see the impact of discipline upon us. How long, O Lord? O Lord, how long will all this continue? How long, O Lord, will you rebuke and chasten me? How long before you show mercy to me? Return, O Lord. Come back to me in mercy and in kindness and deliver my soul. So here you have faith and fear. He's clinging on to the mercies, but he trembles. Will the Lord forget to come back to me? Perhaps for the benefit of younger ones, we might illustrate it this way. It's like a child who has been naughty, and their parent says, go to your room and stay there until I send for you. And they smack them and send them to the room. And they perhaps, in a temper, they start off cross, they cry, but then the longer they wait, they begin to wonder, will I be left here? And they make a noise to see if their mother or father is still listening for them. And they make a little louder noise. Will they come back and say, well, now you may come back and join the rest of us. But there's no response. And they wait. They wait. That's what it's like for the psalmist. How long? O Lord, return to me. For I am weary. I am weak. I am vexed both body and soul. Our greatest struggle is not perhaps with the discipline. Our greatest struggle is with the fears that the discipline brings to us. With its long continuance, perhaps a tragedy happens and we grapple with it and we're perplexed by it. The suddenness of it, the strangeness of it, and the sheer impact of it, the consequences. Like someone that made great plans and got a job and money's coming in and they're making more plans and have started projects and the job goes. And they can't find a job. And the bills pile up. And they fear. And they worry. And it's the length of it that makes them fear. How long, O Lord? O Lord, how long? And all this gives rise to a question, if we can put it like a catechism. In what does our happiness and joy consist? Our happiness and joy consists in knowing that God is merciful towards us. Save me for thy mercy's sake. This is where our joy and our happiness resides. You see, if we are uncertain of the mercy of God, if we doubt whether God is merciful or not, we will be afraid. We will worry. We will tremble. You see, what is it that draws a sinner to God? What draws a sinner to God? What has drawn every sinner to God? It's not the knowledge of God's wrath, but the knowledge that he is merciful to sinners in the midst of wrath. That's what draws them to God. And it's the same for believers. What draws a believer to God continually? It is the knowledge that God is merciful, even in the midst of discipline and chastening. And then secondly, verses 5 to 7, the glory of God. For in death there is no remembrance of thee. In the grave who shall give thee thanks? I am weary with my groaning. All the night make I my bed to swim. I water my couch with my tears. Mine eye is consumed because of grief. It waxeth old because of all mine enemies. Let's have another catechism question, shall we say. In what, or shall we say, what does God look for from us? Answer: thanksgiving and praise. That's what God looks for from us. Psalm 92. It's a psalm or song for the Sabbath day. It is a good thing to give thanks unto the Lord and to sing praises unto thy name, O Most High, to show forth thy loving kindness in the morning and thy faithfulness every night. It's a psalm or song for the Sabbath day. Morning and evening is the Sabbath. Like every other day, but specifically on the Lord's day, to give praise and thanks to God. To offer continually the sacrifice of praise, Hebrews 13:15. So what is David now doing in these verses? Well, David is arguing this way. He's arguing before God. He is presenting an argument to God. He is saying this: if in your chastening and your disciplining of me, you kill me, then these lips and this tongue, which thou hast made to give praise to thee, will cease to do so. The praise that you require of me will not happen anymore. But if you deliver me, then I will remember thee and I will praise thee. The one thing you require of me remains possible. He is saying, you see, God has made us. He made us for himself. He made us to live in praise of him, to serve him, to worship him, to rejoice over him. That's why he made us, as vehicles and instruments of praise. But, says the psalmist, in death, these lips are silent. And again we see the faith of the psalmist. He is thinking through his present circumstances and all that he is facing. Here is the great purpose of existence, to praise God. This is the reality of his life, why he lives, why God saved him in the first place. But here is his perplexity. God is disciplining. He seems to be driving him to the grave. But Lord, if you kill me, these lips will be silenced. This tongue will no longer sing. So on the one hand, he says, you have made me to praise you, but if you kill me, I will not. These two things don't add up. He's perplexed. And we have that in life, don't we? The promises, the providences. Sometimes the one seems against the other. Providence seems to be acting against his promises. While he lives, he will praise. But when he's dead, the lips, these physical lips, will cease to praise God. So what you see is David applying the truth of God's glory to his situation. God is to be glorified. He made us to glorify him. Well, let's take that truth now, says the psalmist. And as he pleads with God, he says, but here is this truth. Here is your own work. You are to be glorified. But I am puzzled. I am perplexed. The application of your way seems contrary to your created purpose. And he struggles. Everything is not a light plane in itself. Sure it isn't. And though it isn't clear and plain to David, it doesn't stop him using it as an argument with God. I don't know the future, but I do know this. When I'm dead, I will no longer be standing at the tabernacle praising God. And so he says, I am weary with my groaning, verse 6. All the night make I my bed to swim. He is crying day and night. Even as he sleeps, he cries. When he rests upon a couch, he cries. Mine eye is consumed because of grief. He feels older. It waxeth old because of all mine enemies. Everything is against me, he says. And it makes me feel old. You see, no matter how bad things are physically, the more he thinks about it, thinking makes it worse. We've long since learned that truth, haven't we? That our mind can always make a bad thing worse than it is. And yet, here's the crucial thing. He never stopped talking to God. He's still talking to God. He's still crying to God. In other words, the discipline, the afflictions, the adverse providences doesn't turn him into an atheist or a deist. He's still a theist. He still believes in God. He still has dealings with God. So all the disciplining, all the scourging, all the chastening, it still reveals a believer. He's still trusting God. And discipline does that, doesn't it? It reveals whether or not our profession of faith is real or false. And there are many, and their troubles turned them from believers to atheists. They said they once believed. They once professed. But show me one who was truly converted, who has forsaken God. There's none. Look at the psalmist. My bones are vexed. It's physical. My soul is sore vexed. It's spiritual. I am weary with my groaning. All the night make I my bed to swim, I water my couch with tears, mine eye is consumed because of grief, it waxeth old because of all mine enemies. But he's still with God. Because you see, the glory of God still matters. It's the glory of God that reigns supreme. God must be glorified, but how can I? I am weary. I am vexed. It seems as if I'm being driven to the grave. But what about your glory? Oh Lord. And again, it's this great word, Jehovah, the covenant God. What about your glory? But the psalmist, that's what really matters. The glory of God. And there's a lesson for us as believers. When disciplined, when chastened, when things are at their worst, does the glory of God still matter? And then thirdly, verses 8 to 10, the kindness of God. As David works his way through all these perplexities and issues and all that is going on, something wonderful happens. As he unburdens himself to God, he himself undergoes a change. There's a dramatic change in verses 8 to 10. Depart from me, all ye workers of iniquity. What has made the change? Three times he makes the same point. God has heard. Look, four. Here's his reasoning. The Lord hath heard the voice of my weeping. The Lord hath heard my supplication. The Lord will receive my prayer. As he has unburdened himself, he himself is changing. Fear is giving way to faith. Perplexity is giving way to purpose. Uncertainty is giving way to certainty. And it was this night that the Lord hears, that the Lord receives his people and their cries unto him. The Lord hath heard my supplications. He has seen all my tears. The Lord has received. Well, let's come to application of this. Five things we draw from it. First of all, though we may complain to God, let us never complain of God. And there is a great difference, as you know. We can bring our complaints to God, but we must never complain of God Himself. We must never say to God, "You are at fault. You are wrong. You should have done this. You should have done that. And if I were you, I would have done the other." It is the ungodly who complain about God. When they always whinge of God. When disaster strike, the first thing they say is, "Where is God? God should have done this. He should have done the other." But not for the believer. The believer has learned we have nothing to complain of about God. We have no wrong things to say of God. But we can bring our complaints to Him. And all our problems and perplexities and worries and fears, all our doubts, we can bring them all to God. That's what the psalmist does. He brings everything to God. And secondly, God's mercy and God's grace is the only light believers have in darkness. You see, we walk by faith. But walking by faith means that often we walk in the dark. We walk through tunnels. We walk through dark valleys. We walk under dark clouds. The sun seems hidden from us. All we see are shadows of things. And we walk through misery and pain and anguish. What is going to keep you going? What will bring you comfort? It's the grace and the mercy of God. You see, the anger of God frightens us, doesn't it? The Lord is angry with the wicked every day. That frightens us. His wrath is upon the sinful. That frightens us. The displeasure of God frightens us. When His countenance is turned away from us, or if He frowns towards us, that frightens us. Just as a child sees the anger in the face of their mother or father, it frightens them. And they pull back. And they step further back because they see that anger is there. Under the wrath of God, how debilitating it is. But grace revives. Mercy encourages. And aren't we told by Paul in Hebrews 4 and the verse 16 to come boldly to the throne of grace? It's a throne. What does a throne do to us? It humbles us. It makes us low. It makes us fall upon our knees. When a commoner, like all of us are, approach a monarch, we bow. In the days when the monarchs were absolute monarchs, they fell upon their face. The monarch, in an instant, could have had them killed. It's a throne
We come with reverence, humility. But it's a throne of grace. And it's the grace that makes the throne attractive. And it's grace that says, come boldly. It is grace and mercy that revives and quickens. It's the light that we have by which we walk in times of darkness, trusting God. Have mercy. Oh, save me for thy mercy's sake. That's what we cling to. Thirdly, a plea for Samaria. There is a realism in these Psalms that is often absent from man-made compositions. Worse, these man-made offerings begin with the view that we want to sing this particular song. That we even want that particular song. And yet, is it not true? Often we come to worship God and we don't feel like singing. We just don't feel like singing. We don't have that great bubbly spirit about us where we want to beam these sunshine smiles. We come feeling miserable, hesitant, doubtful, perplexed. And that's how many of these psalms begin, expressing the misery that we're feeling. They express where we really are. And yet, by the time we get to the conclusion, something has happened. Something has happened to us, the singer. What has happened? Our situation has been explained to us. That's what has happened. And what is more, we have been lifted up out of ourselves. We've been lifted up to heaven. So when we get to the end of the psalm, we want to sing. We started off feeling miserable. Our lips moved like everyone else, but the sound wasn't there. I think I can tell that with some of our singing sometimes. We don't feel like singing. Maybe we've had a bad week or whatever. But see, by the time we get to the end, yes, we do want to sing. We do want to praise God. Why? Because God, by means of these songs and psalms and hymns, has explained to us what we really are feeling. Gives us the explanation of events. The psalms, shall we say, are an argument with ourselves. And we're arguing, as it were, with one another. We are instructing one another. So the one beside us, they're singing to us. And they're saying, friend, here's how you feel. Here's what you're thinking. Now listen. Listen as we go through the psalm. And even the one beside us, in front of us, behind us, as they instruct us, they're lifting us up bit by bit. Then we come. We simply say, yes, God is glorious. God is great. He has been good to me. He has been merciful to me. And I cling to his mercy. And we go home with that song upon our lips. We go home differently than we came. If you don't, then the fault is not with the song. We haven't allowed it to argue with it as we should have. Mercy and grace, lift us up. I make a plea for Samaria. Learn them. Sing them. Let them argue with us. Let them bring us to the throne itself. You can't say that about things that men write or women write. You can't say any of those things. But oh, how precious this whole book of praise is. And then fourthly, David pleads God's character. David cannot plead his own character. He can plead his pain, but never his merits. You see that he never pleads his merits. Oh Lord, he's pleading the character of God, Jehovah, the God who has made a covenant with us. That's what I plead. I plead your very name and character and attributes. I can't plead my own name, but oh, I can bring my pains to thee. I plead my aches and pains. I plead my miseries and my tears. And I plead thy mercies. And friends, we can do the same. Plead the character of God. Plead the merits of God. And yes, we can plead our pains and our perplexities and doubts and fears, but we can never plead our merits. We have none. He doesn't say to God, well, there's merit in what I'm suffering. No, he simply says, see my tears, see my suffering. Oh, return to me. Covenant Jehovah, come afresh to me. How long, O Lord? How long? He pleads the covenant. And then fifthly and finally, let me ask you plainly, simply, pointedly and directly, do you know this God? Do you? You've come to worship God. You've sung praise to God. You've heard his word. You've followed the reading of his word. But do you know him? Do you know him? When in danger, can you speak like the saints? Do you know anything of God's mercies and covenants? Do you know anything of the glory of God and the importance of it? Do you know anything of the kindness of God? The Lord hath heard the voice of my weeping. Do you know this God? Oh, if you know him, then can't you sing of him? We started with Psalm 145. I will extol thee. You can do that if you know him. But if you don't know him, how can you praise him? How can you try and go through life if you don't know God? But if you do know him, then you can face all this discipline, being rebuked and chastened. But only those who are God's children are chastened. May God bless his word to our hearts.